Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Stephen Katz. He's joining us once again. Stephen Katz is the state chair for the Socialist Party USA there in New York, the state of New York. And Stephen is joining our program today where we're going to be discussing some very important topics, such as from the birth of the Socialist Party. And I should say the history of the Socialist Party.
Right.
And we know that the Socialist Party is over 100 years old, but we're going to explore many of the things that took place near the beginnings of that organization. And,
right.
Stephen, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program today.
Thank you, Stuart. It's always a pleasure to be here and to share these ideas and to get them out to the public, because they're not often disseminated.
And Stephen, what we're going to do, and I really appreciate you joining the program. You always bring a lot of insightful information where people can, you know, have food for thought. And
right.
As I mentioned during this segment, we want to discuss why there's a need for why there was a need for a Socialist Party over 100 years ago, and
right.
why there is a need for a Socialist Party today. And Stephen, first, I would like for you to just share what were some of the things that were taking place back in the late 1800s that, you know, people, you know, that, you know, they felt disenfranchised, and they felt that it was a need to move away from the Democrats and Republicans at that time. They thought it was a time for change. But what were some of the things that took place back a little over 100 years ago that brought about a need for a Socialist Party?
Well, I mean, after the Civil War ended, really, that's when modern-day capitalism started to really take root in the United States. And it coincided with quite a bit of emigration from Europe into the United States, and many workers came over here, and, you know, factories, large enterprises, factories arose at that time, and, you know, workers were huddled together. There were very few laws that protected workers to any extent. I would say there were practically no laws prior to the beginning of the real, what I call the revolutionary socialist century, which was the 20th century. I mean, you had child labor, children as young as 14. Sometimes in the New England mills, you had children under 12 working, and there were no laws against that. And, you know, they paid them just barely enough to subsist and reappear at the factory gates the following morning, and the hours were endless, the same as happened in England. England was a little bit of ahead because it happened earlier in England in terms of some response to it, and that, of course, is where the great Karl Marx did his fundamental analysis of capitalism. But wherever it takes root, it follows certain fundamental laws, which he uncovered through analysis. But anyway, in the United States, you had intense exploitation. You had endless hours. And then the workers began to realize that if they organized themselves, they could have a counterweight to what the capitalists were doing. It's also important that many European workers that came over here, they brought socialist ideas with them, because socialism originally as we know it and as we have known it in its more modern form. I'm not talking about utopian socialism, but I'm talking about the socialism of class struggle against capital and the socialism of unionization and so on. That type of socialism took place earlier in Europe, and workers came over here starting with the Civil War era, maybe even before the Civil War era, starting with the European revolutions of 1848, but increasingly as the country industrialized, the workers were coming over here with ideas, and they right. shared it with their fellow workers. And for instance, in the 1880s, there was a very famous demonstration, the Haymarket demonstration, which I believe took place in Chicago in the late 1880s, in which several policemen were killed. Now, that demonstration was a demonstration for the eight-hour day. You have to think about this, because the eight-hour day is something that we're starting to lose now here. Most workers don't enjoy an eight-hour day here. Most workers are beat out of overtime and are forced to work, very long hours here now. But that's what they were fighting back in the 1880s. They were fighting right. to get rid of child labor, to reduce the working day, which was a real struggle. People died, as I said, in that struggle, because obviously the capitalists wanted to extend it as long as possible, because the longer they could extend it, the more value they could get out of the workers, which Marx called surplus value. After paying the worker just enough to have a roof over their head and enough sufficient food to work from one day to the next, the products they made were sold at far greater prices than that, and all of that was gravy to the capitalist. And the longer the capitalist could keep the worker working, actually, the greater the profit. And there was a tremendous push in that direction. And because of that, you had these extended hours. The conditions were bad, of course, there was nothing like OSHA or anything else. I mean, people were breathing in tobacco dust, asbestos, and who knows what, with the steel mills and all of the basic industrialization which was taking place at that time. So now the first unions, of course, you had craft unions, which were quite conservative and were made up of people who had very specialized skills, like railroad engineers or plumbers, certain types of carpenters and other, construction skill trades. But the vast majority of the working class was basically unskilled in specialized technologies. They were hands to feed the conveyor belt or to put together the products or, whatever. And into this mixture of social change and economic development emerged socialism, which, of course, had already been publicized, and workers knew about it here. I mean, you had the Paris Commune in 1871 in Paris, where the workers took over the city, and you had, of course, the Chartists in England, and you had the Irish struggle against the English, you had the Poles struggle against the Russians. You had a lot of ferment going on, and at that time, you had a guy whose name was Eugene Debs, who was the leading guide and founder of the Socialist Party of America. He was he started out painting railway cars, if you can believe it or not. He left high school or junior high school, but he wanted to get employed on the railroad because that was a relatively better paying job than, I guess, working as a clerk at a grocery or as a farmhand. But he had a tremendous native intelligence. He educated himself and he got into the union, and he was the one that busted out of this whole craft union idea and said, no, everybody in this, who's working in this area that we work with has, you know, all belong in a union. And then there was the famous strike that he led against one of the railroads out west, and that really was the birth of the modern socialist movement in the United States, or at least one of the key factors involved. And then around the same time, you had the International Workers of the World, and their philosophy was, we're going to organize all workers into one big union, and we don't care whether you're skilled, unskilled, or what you do. And their philosophy was very revolutionary and went beyond the, not only did it go beyond craft unionism, but it went beyond even the general industrial unionism, because they believed that the workers should take over all of the offices, all of the factories, and all of the means of production. And it was basically Marxism without the idea of a vanguard party or some of the later accretions that came of Lenin and so on. And the Debs at one time was part of that. You had all this ferment. You had the Knights of Labor with Samuel Gompers, which was a rather conservative craft-style union. But the unions became radicalized because of the intense exploitation, which incidentally has come back to the capitalist world now, in the face of the current depression and everything else. And, they decided that they were going to get together and fight it. It's interesting that Debs developed a lot of his early ideas, learn as you do. You know, he was out there and he was working and organizing and observing how the owners acted and how the workers were working and what it took to unionize people and so on and so forth. And you have to remember, this was way back before the National Labor Relations Act and all those other acts. And in the early cases, the owners brought criminal conspiracy cases against these guys for organizing. I mean, they were because they had no federally recognized right to organize, and whatever rights were granted there came through their own struggle. And so in the early days, this is how it emerged. Now, Debs finally was put in jail, and I think it was Grover Cleveland who nationalized the railroad. The reason he did that is because he said that the strike was preventing the U.S. mails from being delivered, which I'm sure it was, because in those days, that's how the mails, were transported throughout the West, the railroad. I mean, they didn't have cars like we have today, and,
Right.
But at any rate, he used that that particular mechanism, and then he was able to put Debs and others in jail. And at that time, when he did put Debs in jail, that's when Debs started studying Marx seriously. So in a way, he helped Debs. He forced Debs to have some time to do some studying. So Debs came out of prison, and he was solely, and then he was really focused on the class struggle and the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. You know, he kind of went in as a general unionist who was radical, and then the whole experience plus the period of study, it's kind of like Malcolm X. I mean, he went into prison, and he read the whole prison library, and he started talking to people, and he came out a completely radicalized person. I mean, the same thing happened to Debs, because they dug in and they said, well, gee, what's the origins of all this suppression and exploitation? And they came out much better equipped to deal with the whole thing. And
I think what happened, capitalism, what was happening, they became their worst enemy, because everything was focused on prosperity and focused on profits for the wealthy. And here Debs came along, and the Socialist Party, and before they even had a split, they were already gaining momentum. But they became a very serious threat to the political establishment at the time, because you have to consider at the time they were drawing from trade unionists, progressives, social reformers,
right.
Populist farmers, immigrants, and these people say, well, here now we have a party, we have an organization that can hear what our interests are. And they could
right.
see from the two main political parties at the time, they weren't being heard. They were being left out. And in
right.
addition to what you mentioned, here was a party and leadership was talking about how they could organize, in the workplace and to deal with many of the issues that would that were affecting working people. So
right.
this was a breath of fresh air at the time. And so when you look at the political establishment at the time, they became a major threat. And then all of a sudden they started thinking, how can we be able to gaining any more momentum? And,
right.
and what happened,
right.
they started infiltrating their organizations. They started
right.
throwing them in jail. People need to understand
right.
how popular that the leadership was. Here was an organization that was in this infantile stages, and running the first presidential candidate received over 900,000 votes. Over 900,000 votes.
Which in those days that was quite a big number. Yeah, right.
It was. It sent
yes.
shockwaves through the political community. In
right,
addition
right.
to that, they saw millions and millions of people across the country were saying, here, this is a political organization that is representing our interests. So all of a sudden, the whole political establishment and all the wealthy elite, they had to turn around and say, here's our workforce. Now they're starting to organize. So it became a political threat. Now they have to look at how can they demonize this organization. And even
right.
then you have to realize that they started – the political establishment started infiltrating those organizations so that they could be able to break up whatever potential interest that they were having with the growing public that was looking in that direction, like what you mentioned about Debs. I mean, Debs, all of a sudden, you know, they started looking at him as a person that was, they came up with all kinds of charges, sedition, statements that he was making, that there were treasonous statements, and eventually they couldn't stop him any other way, so they just threw him in jail. They started making laws.
I mean, there were provocateurs and there were other people, but actually, you know, he ran in 04 and 08, and then in the peak of it was in 1912.
Right, 1912, that's where he got 940,000
right.
votes.
Right, that was the peak of it. But later on, I mean, it was bad enough that Debs, and he wasn't the only one. You had Big Bill Hayward, and you had many others, some of whom are probably lost to history, some of whom, you know, we still remember, who were, you know, great organizers at that time. And then you had World War One, and Debs, to his credit, and I have to say that this is universally recognized, that the Second International, which was strictly Marxist, and Debs, always from the beginning, if you believed in some form of socialism, you were welcome in the Socialist Party USA, or rather at
right.
that time of America. But, you know, you had strictly Marxist parties in Europe, and they were organized into what was known as the Second International, which encompassed the European Socialist parties. And when the war broke out in 1914, all of them, with the exception of Lenin and the Bolshevik Party in Russia, all of them decided that they were going to support their own governments, and they were going to support sending the workers of their own country into other countries to kill the workers of other countries. Well, this set off a big crisis, and, you know, Lenin, you know, had a lot of analysis of this, but But Debs, to his credit, was the only other organized socialist party, our party, was the only other organized socialist party with Eugene Debs as a leader who condemned the war completely, and he made speeches saying, you know, why should our workers go over and kill workers from other countries? He says, we have no interest in this. He says, we should be fighting the capitalists at home, which is, incidentally, the same thing that Lenin was saying in Europe. And I don't even know how much the two even knew about each other or how much they knew. Their instincts were correct and their analysis was correct. Well, that was the last straw here in the United States against Debs, because then he was charged with a law that I believe was passed in 1917, which incidentally they've used to indict Edward Snowden on. That was the Sedition Act.
You're talking about the Espionage Act of 1917.
Correct. And they imprisoned him on that basis.
And that's what they did. That's what they're going after Snowden.
They're using the same statute on Snowden. In fact, they're even trying to smear him and try to call him a Russian spy now. But not to get sidetracked into that. But one reason I bring it up is it shows that you think that with the passage of many, many decades, things are quite different. And then underneath the surface, you realize, no, hell no, they're not quite different. The capitalists are still in power, and they're still doing the same stuff.
Right,
you know, it's
exactly.
A little more sophisticated, you know.
He's kind of polished it up a little bit.
in Debs' day, they used to take informants, you know, and they used to take shorthand. They would sit and they would take down verbatim his speeches. I mean, now they have the NSA, so they don't have guys, you know, in crowds with taking notes. Instead, they have all of this sophisticated technology sucking up, you know, everything anybody ever thought to say to anybody else. But the principle is the same, you know. And so they put him in there, and he was fairly elderly at the time, considered for that time frame. Today,
I wanted to ask you, how well did he do in the first – in his first campaign, because obviously we know the first time he ran was in 1900. 1900. How well did he do in his first campaign?
Well,
because obviously
they were
still in the infantile stage at that time and still organizing.
Right.
But what,
from
what
I
was
understand
it?
That he did very well in his first campaign. I don't have the exact figures, but he did not increase it in the second campaign. It was only in that 1912 campaign.
That was his best results.
That was his best results. And if Theodore Roosevelt was not running on the Bull Moose Party in 1912, who knows? He might have even instead of coming in third, he might have even come in second at that time behind Wilson, because because the race had several different people in it. It had four candidates. It had the Democrat, the Republican, the Socialist, and it had Teddy Roosevelt, who ran on the Bull Moose Party. And
I want to ask you a little bit about the early history of what was taking place in the shortly after the beginning of the Socialist Party. Until World War I broke out, we could see that a lot of people were, you know, they were coming on board, they were joining, but there was a defection from the party because during World War I, or when we got ready to get involved, people thought that we should have been supportive of the war rather than to be opposed to that. But one of the things that I find very interesting, you had socialists that were running for positions in Congress. They were running for state positions in New York, in Milwaukee.
Right.
I mean, they were running in dozens of campaigns across the country.
Right.
And Stephen, this is showing that there was a growing interest nationwide in the Socialist Party, where people were electing these people into the position of mayors, They were elected them in the position of state yeah. offices and also in federal offices. And again, as I mentioned, that became a threat to the political establishment.
No question about it. I mean, you know, like in New York, there were four socialists elected to the New York State Legislature, and they refused to sit the seat them up there. I don't know what pretext they used. You know, they try to keep them out. We did have a couple of congressmen. We had Ira London from the Lower East Side, and I believe there was another one, another socialist that in that era that had been elected to Congress, and I believe they were seated in Congress at that time. And we had mayors throughout the United States being elected. And, of course, this was prior to the Bolshevik Revolution and prior to the advent of Stalin. And, you know, it was a very dynamic thing. The boom of the 1920s in the United States really stopped temporarily the expansion of socialism here, because when the Russian Bolsheviks were successful, the masses were successful in Russia, that gave a shockwave throughout the world. That encouraged everybody, including in the United States. I mean, the workers here were just ecstatic. And if the conditions here had remained as they were in some places in Europe, socialism would have continued to spread like wildfire during that time. But the 1920s became a temporary era of expansion, and that pretty much limited the appeal, because once workers got the idea, mostly inaccurate, but at least temporarily valid for enough people to believe that, you know, capitalism was a system that was going to be beneficial to them, if not immediately, then eventually. And it took the 1929 crash and the 1930s to bring back a more intense interest in socialism. But the
Correct.
Early part of it, you know, was spreading, you know, it was spreading throughout the United States. And, you know, it didn't, at that time, the capitalists had not developed the propaganda, and they did not have the means of disseminating the propaganda to demonize socialism like they did later on. And, you
right.
know, which as the technology increased, it got more and more intense. And in the early days, this was the early days. This was so early that, you know, radio was just getting started. I don't even think a lot of people in the country had radios in their homes. They didn't. A few of the more affluent, you know, might have had a radio, but I mean, it was not. And the major thing was the major way you got your news was through the newspapers. Now, the Socialist Appeal, which was the newspaper of the Socialist Party of America, now Socialist Party USA, had developed a fantastic circulation. I mean, Stuart, it was in the millions. It was unbelievable. It was. At one time, it rivaled the major papers, you know, like the Hearst papers.
Oh, really?
And other papers.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yes, and it was all over the place. And, you know, people would just, the unions would just buy up stacks and distribute it for free. And Debs wrote, I mean, he wrote, every week he had a column in there. And it really affected the public consciousness, because it wasn't so unequal as it is now, although with blog radio and with internet and with other things, we're beginning to equalize it again somewhat. But in those early days, the playing field was somewhat more level when it came to mass psychological influence. And so that was another factor that helped spread the word. And it wasn't only the appeal, but the appeal was tremendous for its time. And there were a lot of other papers in New York and all around that also was disseminating the same type of message. You had, you know, in New York, you had the Freie Arbeiter Zeitung, which was a paper put out by Jewish socialists. And you had, you know, you had papers all over the country in different enclaves. But that was another factor in the increase of consciousness which occurred.
Stephen, I'm just going to make a very brief announcement. Just wanted to mention once again, we have Stephen Katz. He is the state chair with the New York Socialist Party USA. He's joining our program once again. He comes on every other week. Stephen, today he's discussing the history of the Socialist Party in America. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Socialist Party today. What we're going to do is we're going to look a little bit about some of the changes that happened around World War I, World War II, and also how the Socialist Party was able to grow, and also what took place during the Depression, because we can see a lot of the programs that were introduced in Washington, they were introduced as a result of what the socialists were talking about. But let's look at first at World War I, because, Stephen, at the time, there was a defection from the party around that time. And we had to consider, we didn't have the information that we have today. A lot of people, a lot of the roots of people, that what was taking place during that time in Europe, a lot of people sympathized and they wanted U.S. involvement. It was a lot easier to be able to get the information out where people felt that they needed to be, the country needed to be involved in that war. We need to understand that the country was still basically isolationist. They weren't interventionists. Right. But you have to realize that the roots of many millions of people that lived in this country, they were from Western Europe. So they wanted the U.S. to get involved. So at the time when the party was saying that we should not be involved in the war because they understood what war was all about. War is about, you know, it's all about capitalism. It's all about increasing profits. It had nothing to do with the benefits of the working class. Had everything to do with the industrialization of Europe and the U.S. at the time. So we got involved. What happened? Why was there defection from the party? Why did many people that were coming on board wanting to get involved, why did they move away? Why was it because of the lack of information from the party at the time or the dissemination of information? Why did people leave the party then?
You mean...
I know it's not the statistically that you can quote from, but what is your opinion about that, Stephen?
You mean people who left the, not only the party, but the socialist movement?
Right, exactly. That's what I'm talking about, the socialist movement.
Well, I mean, first of all...
And I was incorrect. I meant the socialist movement. I didn't mean the party.
Yeah, well, I mean, it happened in both, but... and, of course, the Socialist Party of America was a major party, but there was Daniel De Leon had a Socialist Labor Party, and there were a couple of other parties around. And, of course, there was quite a community of anarchists, Emma Goldman and others, who joined causes against World War I. But once the decision was made to enter into the war, a huge propaganda machine, the largest of its kind up to that date, exceeding even the Civil War, was brought on. And I think in those days, too, with due respect to our ancestors, they were less sophisticated when it came to being able to evaluate propaganda. And, you know, the Kaiser's soldiers were bayoneting babies and all kinds of crazy stories that came out, and they put on all kinds of propaganda, you know, the Huns and all this, and, you know, the other parties involved, and, you know, and they made it seem like a great idealistic endeavor to spread democracy. It all sounds familiar, doesn't it? And a lot of people, simple good people who, you know, had no way of really evaluating this information were, of course, went into the army, and you had the draft. I believe there was a draft in World War I.
Right, it was.
Yeah, there was a draft, and You know, that was another issue, and I believe that's the issue that got Emma Goldman on, the great anarchist woman who was deported to Russia.
Exactly.
For fighting, for fighting against the conscription. And so as hard as the socialist and anarchist press was and the speech-making was, they just could not counter a combination of a massive propaganda machine emanating out of Washington, using all the new methods of mass print production and radio with what they had to work with. And they were always outmatched, but this really tipped the scales over. And, of course, this was the first really – I mean, the Civil War was a horrible conflict, and many, many people were dead, you know, died. But by the time of World War One, the younger people had no memory of that. And, you know, the real horror of the war was not known to the people who went in, and they were thinking in idealistic terms, you know, and then they got over there, and then people came back, as they come back now from the imperialist wars, maimed, dead.
Right.
And, you know, so
their war is our blood.
Yeah, and, you know,
well,
human
let
beings
me ask
are
you
so,
this.
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, we can see that, you know, it was obviously propaganda
right.
that led us, people to want to support that war. Now
right.
the capitalists, they have become a lot more sophisticated because
right.
we can see as a result of World War II, you know, the propaganda machine was in, you know, it was running full speed ahead. Because
right, right.
all of a sudden, even though they understood what was taking place with the Japanese, first of all, the capitalists helped to build the Japanese empire. And then after that, you know, they can see what has taken place before Pearl Harbor even took
right.
place. And all of a sudden, Pearl Harbor takes place, and we're in a war. We can see that 9/11, it took place. And before you know it, they've been very sophisticated. They say, all right, it's weapons of mass destruction. Now we've been involved in conflicts over there for well over a decade. So they've become very sophisticated. But then, you know, it was appealing to people's sense that here are you know, the native countries that we have been, that our ancestries are from, and they wanted
right.
to get involved. And now these wars, what many of the leaders in the Socialist Party was trying to explain at the time, that these wars were only to bring about our blood, and there was
right.
wars for the capitalists. And that hasn't changed today. But I want to just, because we only have around 15, a little less than 20 minutes here, I want
right.
to just take us, we're going to get back into World War One, what took place there with the party and how they
right.
were involved. But let's look at what took place in the 20s. We could see what was happening like in 2008. We had a greater depression than what we had, the Great Depression. This was a greater depression that took place in 2008. But
right.
what happened in the 20s, we could see the same thing, what we saw happening from 1995, 2000, 2005.
Right.
And the capitalists, they were benefiting from that. And then after that, then there was the crash. And then who benefited from that crash after it took place? It was as they started creating jobs and building the country again, not only here, but in Europe, we could see the industrialists, they started gaining wealth just like they're gaining today.
Right.
But it was done on the backs of labor.
Right.
Now we can see the Socialist Party. I want you to talk about many of the things that how socialists was able to put a spotlight on what was taking place and how it wasn't benefiting working people. And what we could see that came about in even the New Deal that was introduced back in the 30s, the socialists were talking about those things. Talk about some of those programs that they even introduced that socialists were involved in back in the 30s. Could you share a little bit
yeah.
about that?
Yeah, definitely. FDR adopted, and his so-called brain trust who were, you know, they were I guess the most innovative thinkers he had around him. Always thought within the parameters of capitalism, but things were so bad, he just told them, look, let's just keep trying things until we find something to work. They were not hemmed in by anything else, and the Socialist Party had been pushing unemployment insurance. The Socialist Party had been pushing public jobs. The Socialist Party had been pushing many of the programs that the New Deal eventually started to put into place in order to get people back to work and in order to give people some sense of social security. And, you know, they adopted it at that time. They had to adopt it. And FDR, as part of his coalition, were the labor unions. And, of course, they were pushing for this type of stuff as well. And so that's where they co-opted picked up.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we can see that many of the things that the socialists have talked about for decades, the labor unions, they talk about the same thing, but the labor unions are very easily absorbed into the Democratic Party. So many of the ideas that we have seen for decades that socialists have been advocates of, the Democrats absorb those ideas, and next thing you know, we see those same things being introduced, many times not in the same fashion that they're being introduced by socialists, but watered-down versions. But anyway, continue your thought.
Yes, well, in the beginning, there was an evolution with the unions, because you still had pretty radical unions back in those days, and the Teamsters, and then you had the CIO, and a lot of these unions, particularly the CIO, and I would say to some extent the Teamsters, they absorbed not only from the socialists, but they also absorbed from the IWW, and they were quite willing to engage in class warfare. In other words, they were quite willing to physically fight the capitalists, when they were locked out of plants and when they were laid off and so on and so forth. And, in those days, and then, of course, the laws started to get passed. And in the early days of the unions, a lot of this radicalism, even in the AFL, was influenced. Now, people don't realize it today, some people anyway, and I don't know how much of this they're teaching in the public schools today, but the birth of industrial unionism, real large-scale unionism, came in Detroit when the workers took over the automobile factories. The workers physically took them over, and they stayed in them. And they were in them, and they got support. People, just like the Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago, much more recently, which was an isolated incident, but it gave you the idea. But this was massive. I mean, this was totally massive. And and that is how the first contracts between the UFW and the major automakers came about. They didn't come about because they went to the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington, D.C., and were sipping martinis and sat down and, had rational Socratic dialogue and came out and said, okay, this is what's going to happen. That's not what happened at all. I mean, that was just ruthless, and a lot of people died. I mean, a lot of workers died. And the capitalists employed Pinkertons. Today, of course, they mainly employ the police forces.
Right.
But
Homeland Security.
Yeah, and the police.
No, I understand that, but.
Yeah, I know. And the
Pinkerton.
They employ the Pinkertons, but to my way of thinking, one of the big investment banks gave the New York City Police Department during the Occupy Wall Street days billions of dollars to buy equipment, which never should have been permitted. For use against the demonstrators, and to me, there's no difference than the and I forget which organization it is, so I don't want to venture a guess, which one it was, but it was one of the major investment banks. And and that's just, to me, it's the equivalent of, you know, paying the Pinkertons. I mean, you know, it's not a force to protect the interests of the masses of workers and to see everything is okay with them, although it partially does fulfill that. But in situations like this, it becomes a paid repressive force. And, you know, and that's not a politically – the police in an ideal situation are supposed to be what they were in China under Mao Zedong. They're supposed to be safety officers. Safety officers means, first and foremost, they come from the communities that they patrol, and their first obligation is to protect the civilians, to protect the people. Their first obligation is not to stop and frisk the people, to club the people, to put the people in jail for demonstrating for their rights. They're there that if, you know, somebody gets hurt or somebody needs assistance or to help with the traffic, and that's their primary, and to, of course, to protect from crime, but, you know, ordinary crime. But that is a, you know, that's a different concept than having a force, and it's not just here in New York, it's all in all the major cities, a force which is armed with weaponry that will rival the weaponry of armies around the world to use against their own domestic populations.
Yeah, it's incredible to even believe
it. It's, and pretty soon we're going to have the drones. We have
oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
The,
hey, folks,
the drones
anyone
will be used.
They're coming.
The drones will be used now. But go ahead,
because
I know what time
it won't be. It won't be drones just for surveillance. Right now, they're
oh, no, I mean, believe me, we're step by step, we'll be living in a state that even George Orwell could never have dreamed of.
Exactly. We have 10 more minutes, and Stephen, you know, it's a lot of things I would like to cover. I want to cover a little bit more about the recent history of the Socialist Party USA.
Right.
Because we can see in 1973 there was a reorganization of the party. And I just want to talk a little bit about that. We could see in 1973 when they ran their first presidential candidate, and that was Frank Zeidler. Of course, he was the mayor of Milwaukee. And what took place around that time? Explain to our listeners that brought about the birth of the rebirth, I should say, of the Socialist Party USA.
Well, first, I think I just have to preface this by saying that in all parties, in most parties, although you won't find it in the Republican Party today, and it's barely in evidence in the Democratic Party, but in most parties, particularly in the Socialist parties, you had a left wing and a right wing. Now, right after, and during the final phase of World War One, there was a split in the Socialist Party. That was the first split in the Socialist Party of America. The left wing of that party formed themselves into the Communist United, I think it was the United Communist Workers, and they eventually merged with another party, and they became the first Communist Party in the United States. And they were, John Reed was in that party. Now, Debs didn't take sides in this split, but it's reported that he definitely supported the left wing and declared himself a Bolshevik, and this was, you know, during and after the Bolshevik Revolution, but he tried to stay out of faction fights, but he definitely was more on that side. If you get the movie Reds, which was made many years ago but is in DVD now, and you can get it over, I think you can even get it over instant Amazon, over your computer, it shows that early split, because the right wing of the party did not want to get into active opposition against the U.S. entrance and promulgation of World War One. They were against war, but they didn't want to make it more specific than that. Whereas John Reed and Big Bill Hayward and Eugene Debs and others, They said, no, no, heck no, we got to go out, we got to fight this. We can't just make some kind of statement in a convention and go home. You know,
that's right.
Now, so you had the right and left wings there. And in the right wing there, you had Victor Berger and you had Hillquist, just to mention a few people from the other side, who were more professional men or intellectuals, and although you did have your intellectuals in the left wing. Now, to bring it up to the present, during the 1960s, you had, again, the buildup of a split because Max Shackman, who was a former Trotskyist, entered the Socialist Party in the late 50s. Shackman became more and more conservative to the extent that he became a union bureaucrat with George Meade and was actually supporting the Vietnam War. And not only did he support the Vietnam War, he was supporting the invasion of Cuba. So Max Shackman, who started out in the Communist Party in the 20s as a real radical, ended up, he ended up practically being a Reaganite by the end of his life. But now, so there was a crisis in the party at that time between the Shackmanites and those who saw their bread and butter and their power within the labor bureaucracy of the AFL-CIO, which had George Meany at the head of it, and he was very well named because I remembered the way he looked. He looked like the meanest son of a bitch you're ever going to want to see. If I saw a guy like that in an alley, I would either pick up a club or I'd run in the other direction. But at any rate, guys like David Gretels, who's still a member of our party and is a wonderful man, he's in his 80s now, he and other people form what was known as the Debs Caucus. And the Debs Caucus goes back to, hell no, we're anti-war. We got to fight, against the Vietnam War, just the way Eugene Debs and our socialist predecessors did in World War I.
How close is the platform of the party now as comparing to the platform of the party 110 years ago? Obviously we know both are multi-tendency parties.
Right.
I shouldn't say parties. It was multi-tendency then, multi-tendency today. Of course, the issues, there are a much broader range of issues today because, more communication like that. But from the inception of the party, how is it very closely aligned to what was back at the turn of the 20th century as looking today in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think it is very closely aligned because our party platform now favors workers' control and favors a transitional socialist state. So in other words, we favor the not only worker, but community control. It's a bit broader because, the realization came that there are many people who don't work in a remunerative capacity, but they do work, be they working at home or whatever, or maybe it's just the guy who lives in a neighborhood and sleeps on a grate, but that person is still a human being. So all of the people, the masses, will control their communities and will control their local businesses, create co-ops, that the workers will control the means of production as well as their own local communities, and there will be a transitional socialist state, which is the reason that we run candidates, because we want to get into the state apparatus, and then when there are enough masses of people mobilized, and I personally favor a national strike, which Rosa Luxemburg felt was a very good tactic, and create a revolution in which we have a state which serves the masses of people, and we have it controlled by the masses of people, and the masses of people control their own communities. And that remains our platform, and I believe it's fairly close to what Debs had worked towards 100 years ago. Of course, in his day, he was working step by step. Now we have a much more complete process. I would say, and the party has always been multi-tendency. I was just reading recently a book by James Cannon, who was one of the early Trotskyists and also was in the CP in the 20s, called The First 10 Years of American Communism. And
right.
he was talking about, you know, also, you know, these same issues and how the, you know, what was necessary. Now, he criticized Debs for having a multi-tendency party. This book, incidentally, was written in the 50s, and so it was after the Stalin era. And he claims that, you see, that the Soviet Union, the Bolsheviks and the Soviet Union had tremendous prestige because they created the first successful socialist revolution. It was not a coup, as is taught in a lot of the colleges. It had the masses of people behind it because of its platform of ending the war, distributing food, distributing land, which Kerensky, you know, didn't have. Kerensky was going to continue the war, and Kerensky represented the capitalists and the landowners. But,
And Stephen, I have like less than a minute because I'm going to want
right.
you to give some contact information. After you finish what you say, I have 1 minute. Could you tell people how they can reach you?
Yeah, well, they can write Steve Katz, care of the Socialist Party USA, 339 Lafayette Street, New York, New York. If you Google Socialist Party USA and in the internet, you'll find out. You'll get the zip code, but there's all of the documents, the Constitution, the Members Handbook. You can join online. There are chapters throughout the United States. We are spreading. We are adding. And California is growing by leaps and bounds. I can't tell you every day.
Oh, we're growing like crazy.
Like crazy.
Yeah,
we're ready to call
the fire department.
It's like 5 and 10 people a day now.
Hello?
Yes.
Again, I wanted to thank everyone for joining us. Stephen, we'll see you in 2 weeks, okay?
All right. I'll talk to you, Stuart and Ruth. Thank you. And have a good evening, comrades.
Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. On blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
How's it going, everybody? This is Nikolai Brown. I'm your host. This is Dialectics. Thanks for joining us this week. We have a very special guest, Jessica, with Deep Roots United Front. We'll get to her in just a second. Before that, I got some updates from Weekly Bolshevik. This week, we got a couple speaking tours happening. First one First Nations National Liberation speaking tour that's going on in the Northwest. Also in the Northwest, Rod Coronado is speaking. In Denver, we got the Radical Study Groups, Communism 210, and also a Spanish language Communism Study Group. Be sure to check those out. Unfortunately, Omali Yeshitello couldn't be with us this evening. Hopefully, we'll get him on another week. Our best wishes go out to him. But we do have Jessica from Deep Roots United Front. How is it going?
It's going great.
Thanks for joining us. Let us know a little bit about Deep Roots, what you guys are all about, or how and why you guys came together. I know you guys are a fairly new group.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Deep Roots United Front. We're an organization committed to working with and in frontline communities on various struggles. We're an all people of color organization, and we focus on a multitude of issues, from police violence and brutality to ongoing genocide of peoples here, indigenous people, via alcohol and things like that. However, we have the understanding that all of these intersecting forms of oppression with race and gender and heterosexism, these are really important. And again, our focus is people of color, so very rooted in that. As you know, these are also key systems that are destroying the planet. So while we work and are committed to frontline communities of color, we feel very strongly that, you know, we are here to stand by and protect all of our relatives, human, non-human alike.
Cool. How did you guys come together, or what was the impetus for starting this group?
Well, you know, there was a few of us who were who had been working together for a couple of years already in Deep Green Resistance, and then there's other folks who came from different organizations and working in the movement in different capacities, and all of us had similar experiences of, you know, those either in just the overall on the left and in the environmental movement in general, it being white dominated and not really focusing on the concerns of our communities and focusing their energies on the front lines of a lot of pollution, environmental destruction, which the vast majority of it are in communities of color. And so we got together and we just working on different things throughout the year, and we decided, you know, yeah, this is time for this. And that's what we did.
Nice. What were some of your first actions, or what have you guys come together to do so far?
One of our big things that we did collectively as sort of us coming together, we were already kind of talking, having the plans of creating this organization, but this summer, the end of August, beginning of September, we did some actions in Pine Ridge, on the Pine Ridge Reservation, with fighting liquid genocide there. Just to give a brief introduction, just explaining it a bit, Pine Ridge is a reservation in South Dakota, and on the border of Pine Ridge is a town called White Clay, and they sell primarily to the Lakota on Pine Ridge, which is a dry reservation. They sell about 13,000 cans of beer every single day, and you go there and you'll see people passed out on the street. People have died there in the extreme weather, in the extreme heat, extreme cold. One of our members was there at, there was a camp that we were there at and helping to support materially for some time, that was Camp No Tolerance. And the camp was there to have a permanent stand against the legalization of alcohol. And what happened was there was someone who was there, a few folks were there, and they saw that a woman was being attacked. And so they rushed in and they prevented a rape from actually happening. So those are the kinds of things. And then also bar owners are known for selling women, for buying and selling women, trading them for alcohol. So it's a bad place. But anyway, we did some actions that summer to disrupt operations for a time and get people informed about the issue. And then after that, a group of us, we got together and gotten some of the planning stages with the organization. And then following that, a lot of us met at an action camp that happened in Utah this summer that was geared towards stopping tar sands development, which if anyone's familiar with how that's happened, how tar sands mining has affected people in Canada, specifically First Nations people and the land, they'll know it's devastating environmentally and in all kinds of other ways. So we did an action one day to disrupt operations.
Cool. Nice. Definitely that's a huge operation that's going on up there. It's going to destroy a lot of land, going to kick a lot of people off their indigenous land, and it's good to see that people are standing up to that. Well, tell us a little bit more about kind of what Deep Roots United Front believes in, what you're about, kind of what's the politics and then the overall ideology behind it.
You know, another thing, well, first I'd like to just kind of share something that I can speak off the cuff, but I think I'm
of course
a better writer. And I wrote an introduction talking about our group, and just part of it was basically the forming of this organization and our declaration of who we are and what we stand for has been a long time coming. Many of us have spent much of our time in white-dominated and controlled leftist environmental movements and had at some point felt mounting frustrations with what we experienced and saw as of a lack of prioritizing the needs and struggles of impacted communities of color. Issues of poverty, police brutality, immigration, chemical warfare, and prison incarceration were seen as virtually disconnected from the fight for and protection of the land. However, all too often it is our communities designated as sacrifice zones for industrial capitalist profits. And some facts that are startling is that more than 72% of African Americans live in counties that violate federal air pollution standards. Black children have, it's alarming, like a 500% higher death rate from asthma compared to white children. 66% of Hispanics live in areas that do not meet federal government air quality standards, and that's compared to 58% of whites. And this last one that's really interesting is, according to the state of the World's Indigenous Peoples Report by the United Nations, more than half of indigenous adults over the age of 35 have type 2 diabetes, with numbers predicted to rise. And people may think, I mean, there's definitely the aspect of Native people, indigenous peoples living in areas that are called food deserts, where there's not access to good foods. And that's definitely a factor, but there's also studies that have shown connections between persistent organic pollutants and higher rates of diabetes. So that's something people don't quite think about. And so, I mean, a phrase that we have in our organization is called deeds, not words. It's a phrase we stand by. And another thing we notice is on the left in white-dominated movements, there's this tendency to focus so much on, oh, you don't believe this strain of leftist politics that I believe in. You're an anarchist, I'm a communist, what have you, and just getting caught up in ideological bickering. And we take firm stances against various forms of oppression. I think it goes without saying firmly anti-capitalist, but we tend to not, the big thing for us is not to be about preaching ideology. And I mean, obviously ideology is of some kind is motivating what we do and why we created this, but we are really focused on the actions that we take in the communities that we work with, and also stressing the importance that in the left in general, a shift happens towards more of that.
Yeah, that's definitely something that needs to be focused more on. You had mentioned your kind of collective experience in the white left and how that left you a little disappointed, I suppose. What were some of the, and you mentioned there wasn't enough focus on issues facing oppressed communities. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
On what? Excuse me, sorry.
Your experience and the way that the white-led left has kind of has ignored many of the issues that directly affect the most oppressed people in the United States.
Right. Let's see. I mean, I think a good example of that would be, I've talked to other people in the past who have coming across people in the white environmental movement and or left, and they'll say things like, say we may be the few that are there in a white-dominant space, and if we bring up, we need to reach out more to people of color and get them involved. There's this almost this idea like, oh, but how can we get them involved? How are we going to get them interested? Or they're worried about primary survival needs. And a lot of excuses in this idea essentially that people of color don't care about the earth, don't care about pollution. And that's some of the stats I read off. We are the most impacted by these things. But there's just a general a fear. There's the racism that's there and the fear of the unknown reaching out and working with people that they're not used to working with. I've talked about briefly how we've been doing work in Pine Ridge over liquid genocide. We've also been attending trainings that have been happening there and other reservations called Rockets on the Ground, and those have been trainings preparing put on by the White Plume family there in Pine Ridge and others. That these are trainings that prepare people for the pipeline, if it's going to go through the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. And so training people in media skills, nonviolent civil disobedience, knowing your legal rights, and activists and just people within the community itself, knowing these things are really important. Native indigenous peoples and their lands and people of color in general are designated as the sacrifice zones for industrial capitalism.
That's definitely the case. I mean, we see that all across the United States that, even in the United States, it tends to be a thing that, like, the east side of town tends to be the poor side of town. And the reason is because the trade winds blow east. So that's where all the industrial pollution of a town blows to. And, of course, the rich people don't want to live on that side of town. So it generally becomes an area that's more populated by people of color, by oppressed nationalities, and what have you. And I was wondering if you could go into that more, because that you mentioned frontline communities facing, these environmental problems. And I'm sure that's, a pretty widespread problem all across the country. But what are some of the examples that you've seen in your work?
I was wanting to talk a bit about some of the work that we have been doing, those of us in our various areas with frontline communities. In Omaha, Nebraska, for example, there's been a lot of coalition building and work being done there. Two things that are major issues there is one is police brutality is really bad. There's something that just came out today. I could look it up quickly, but it was an article saying that Omaha is the worst, most dangerous place to live in this country if you're black, apparently, in terms of the brutality and things like that. And so there's a group there called FTP that's been doing really great stuff with honing that in and getting the community recording the police and fighting back. And so we've been doing work with them. Also, there's been a problem with There's a coal plant in Omaha that, of course, is in the poor area of town where, again, and also where people of color are at, that causes a number of people to die every year. And the thing is, it's not even a necessary coal plant. The energy, the excess energy that it generates is sold off. So it's not even an argument that can be made that this is a necessary thing for people's homes to be heated, this is that. I mean, this is a totally for the, you know, as far as the state's concerned, a totally for-profit factory thing that's going and that's killing people.
That's a really interesting observation. I mean, you had mentioned, like, sacrificed lands, the way that, you know, oppressed people are being sacrificed, their health is being sacrificed so that, you know, this energy conglomerate can sell a little bit of its excess, you know, energy to the neighboring town or to the neighboring counties or whatever. So it's interesting how the oppressed people of this area are kind of, you know, like you mentioned, being sacrificed for this profit motive. And, you know, that's everywhere in a sense. I mean, whether it's in the United States or around the world. Have you guys done much outreach kind of internationally? I know there's a lot of kind of indigenous activism going on in Latin America against development and in South Asia and things like that.
Yeah, we've actually had a couple of members who have just gotten back from a trip visiting the Zapatistas in Mexico, which is really great to have that connection be made. And really, you know, just talking to one of the members who did that today, learned some really valuable things about how we build a successful resistance movement, how we build community. That was really powerful. And
well, it seems like those two things aren't necessarily disconnected. You almost need the community to have the resistance and vice versa.
Oh, exactly. That's the point. Oh, exactly. I mean, the people, they have such a sense of, from what I've been told, a sense of loyalty to one another for the life that they're building and things like that. And for them, it was just very refreshing to see that. And I feel there is so much that we need here in this country to learn from that, because I feel there's a lot of folks on the left who don't necessarily, that needs to be worked on, this idea of community, because we're so, in this culture, separated from each other. I mean, community over the last 50 years or a little longer has really been broken down, and we've gone automized.
It's been a conscious strategy too. The kind of gentrification that's happened within the last 30 years has really broken up oppressed communities within the United States and made it even harder to organize resistance movements, because that community is not there. So it's almost like you have to start from square one in a lot of ways.
It's really unfortunate, but I mean, that is where we're at right now. And that's, you know, and also, again, kind of going back to what I said earlier about deeds, not words, that's kind of the hard stuff, is getting people and communities that you want to work with or you're working with to trust you. But
yeah, certainly. That's a big issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I imagine that's something you deal with a lot going, if you're, you know, doing actions where you go to a place like Pine Ridge, as being an outsider to some extent, it probably takes a little bit for the community to warm up to you. It takes work on your part too. It's not just something you can expect people to like you because you're there. You can't show up here, I'm here to help, and expect people to, you know, start jumping for joy necessarily.
Yeah. I mean,
but going back to Pine
Ridge. Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just saying, talking about that with Pine Ridge. I mean, we've just developed deep roots, but there's some of us who have founded this organization have been building that relationship and going out there for about 3 years now. And I mean, one of our members knew someone who was there who brought us in, And, you know, it took some time to build that trust, but that happened. That did happen. And the thing is, to be understood, is that solidarity is not, first of all, it's not charity in the sense of, kind of there's a problem of, like, we're not white, but, I mean, the whole white savior complex, that we're going to come and save you. I mean, that's something that people have had to deal with for some time. But also being like, no, I mean, I'm not here to save you. I'm here to join you in mutual struggle. And finally, solidarity is not also a one-time thing. I think some people in this culture of instant gratification, or, you know, just things happen fast, lose patience, or also they go and they do something, one thing, in the community, and they don't commit and stay for the long haul. And solidarity is a forever thing. I think that's another important lesson.
Certainly. Yeah, it's not something you go and take a picture and then you have it to show your friends or something like that in the future. But going back to Pine Ridge, that number you threw out there earlier kind of blew my mind. You said 13,000 cans of beer a day. That's about 4.7 million cans of beer a year. And it's basically all sold to members of this or people live on this reservation. And there's only, 3,300 people who live on this reservation. So it gives you a sense of what you call the liquid genocide. And, you know, the Black Panthers describe the same thing as kind of chemical warfare being waged against. And it's really... toll on the community there and everything. What are some of the ways, what did you do to try to inhibit or prevent the sale of booze or whatever that damage that was being done?
Well, there's been a lot of things that have been done. Last summer, I believe it was in June, I'm trying to remember when exactly, June or July, a couple of us went with the current president brewer of the Pine Ridge Reservation, we met with him, in the capital of Nebraska, Lincoln. And he was giving a talk at a church about the situation in Pine Ridge, and also went to talk with the governor himself about how there could be some solutions, some things to be done. And just to briefly state some facts, in original treaties, Pine Ridge White Clay was designated as a buffer zone where alcohol was not to be sold. However, in the 1900s, that was reversed illegally by executive order Theodore Roosevelt. And then finally, in other treaties, that whole part of Nebraska really belongs to the Lakota people, the tribe. But those were in many other treaties with First Nations people here is broken.
A single square inch of the United States that wasn't stolen at some point. And I think for there really to be, any sort of long-term justice to be established in the world, any sort of long-term peace to an extent, that land has to be returned. The United States, I mean, people don't like to hear this, but in a lot of ways, the United States needs to be dissolved, and a lot of that land needs to be returned to the people who lived there prior to that. And a lot of people don't like to hear that, but the truth is going to happen sometime in the future. The question is how it happens.
Yeah, I mean, the United States has always been an empire, and I don't think there's any reforming it, and I don't think any sort of revolution could keep that empire, that country, that entity, whatever, intact. The president went to talk to the governor about the situation, trying to come to some agreements about things and work on the issue. And he talked to him for about 5 minutes or so. The governor, from what I heard, was very disrespectful, threw a paper or news article down the table and was very angry with President Brewer. And basically it was a statement that's true that the governor receives about $90,000 in campaign contributions from the liquor industry. And so that was revealed, and he was very unhappy about it. And there was another time we went to Lincoln to have a press conference talking about, we saw people there in, there was the Camp Zero Tolerance that was established for some time. There, the bar owners were giving bats and different things to the people who were on the streets there, giving them back to attack people at the camp. And the camp, mostly women and children that were there, and this was photographed. And T.R. McKenzie, he's one of the founders of Deep Roots, he went and to the alcohol commission to file a report. We were going to have a press conference, and he was actually arrested right before he was to go to the press conference, and I had to give it in his place. But he was arrested. He thank goodness a lot of the charges are settled now. He settled, so things are good on that front. He just has probation. However, he's also on now he's on the S list, which is I can't remember the acronym, but it basically means when he flies, he has to go through all of these checkpoints, and he has to go through all this additional screening. And he's never been convicted of a violent crime or gone to prison. And it's highly suspected by us that his work there with in Pine Ridge fighting the alcohol brought him to the attention of people in Nebraska, and he's on that list. And I guess I just bring that up to show just an example of the government repression of activists, and that's still, that's something we have to be concerned about.
Fighting liquid poison, liquid genocide, like you call it, earns you a place on the U.S. some list somewhere. That's definitely an example of repression. Well, I hope that all those charges clear up for him, and he'll be able to continue the struggle.
Oh, he is, and there still are. He just has probation for some months now, and he can't go into white clay essentially until he's off probation. Yeah, and this is one more thing I wanted to mention. We have also folks that in Deep Roots who just getting back from the Dene Reservation in Arizona, and basically there's plans to work with them and help with the cultural revival camp, which would be really important, learning various things about just the culture. Planting. Also, uranium mining is a really big problem down there. I mean, that's another, again, a sacrifice zone. So wanting to point that out, it's like working in lots of different areas where we can. And we're still in the process of trying to grow and recruit more people. And the goal is to of our organization is two-pronged. One is to be there in direct actions that happen against whatever issues that are coming up, be it police brutality, poverty, like as I mentioned, liquid genocide issues, environmental destruction, what have you, being there in nonviolent direct action. And then also a key thing is survival programs in these frontline communities. The Black Panthers and the food programs that they had, that the free breakfast programs they established come to mind. So sustainability in that sense and shelter. And also the key core of this is the fight for land, because that's how they control us, is because they cut off our access to land. I mean, if we could go outside and drink from the rivers, I mean, we wouldn't have any need to buy bottled water now, would we?
I mean, just to have an economy, have a people, you need land, and when somebody else controls that land, it really, I mean, that's the situation of subjugation and oppression. You mentioned earlier that you kind of have this anti-capitalist orientation. Why is that? Why don't you think why does that go together? This sort of deep roots ecological perspective, focused on oppression, and the anti-capitalist perspective. And I, of course, I'm fully on board with you. I'm kind of throwing out this out to be a devil's advocate, but I'm just kind of wondering your opinion. Why can't some of these things be pursued within the paradigm of capitalism?
Okay, I'm just going to give my take as an individual that helped found the organization, because in essence, I mean, we are anti-capitalist, but we do try. I mean, they're not like we're all in agreement, not compatible with our vision, but we do try to as much as we can not focus so much on ideology. But anyway, me talking right now, I mean, capitalism commodifies everything. Everything, is here to be bought and sold and owned by somebody, with, people of color for even now. But, I mean, you can look back in 200 years or so, are not human beings, living beings, or things to be bought. Women are not human beings of, they are to be bought, they are to be used. They, because it all comes down to resource extraction. Again, as far as people of color are concerned, making it as though they're not living beings, we can use them have them be used for labor and steal their land. Women, having them used for labor, sexual purposes, extraction in terms of forced childbirth, and then with the land, which so many people, even on the left, don't see as living and having rights within themselves, the water, the animals, what have you. I mean, a mountain, it's just a mountain. It's not a living thing. It's not anything. We can just destroy it and mine it. The water isn't important in any way. We can just use it. And with this paradigm, I mean, you can't have sustainability within capitalism either, because, I mean, a real economy that, to me, makes sense would have, understanding, all right, the real quote-unquote economy is, all right, the real world is the natural world. So we need to live in balance with the natural world. Whereas, people, because of this economic system, it's like I talk to these things with people, and they're totally, completely blinds them from that reality, that we're in a physical, natural world that has limitations and limits. And, with capitalism, it's all about more, it has to constantly grow, because if it's not constantly growing, the economy or whatever, then it collapses. So that sounds like, I don't know, I mean, so it has to constantly grow and consume more and more. That's the ideology of a cancer cell, from what it sounds like to me.
And it will be interesting. I mean, we definitely live on this finite earth, so whenever... At some point, once we've used up so many of these resources, it's going to become a catch-up game where we're just going to be, so much is going to be trying to just hang on and preserve our old style of life versus, expanding as much. But it will be an interesting kind of turning point once that happens, and we'll see how people respond to it, I suppose. And hopefully, there'll be organizations like Deep Roots, United Front, that are organizing people for a better alternative. And speaking of which, alternative energy is a big thing these days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another way that kind of capitalism tries to make itself look good, tries to provide some sort of false solution and try to bamboozle people with it. What's your take on solar and wind and all of this stuff?
Yeah, well, you know, as an organization, we don't have an official stance, but, I mean, a lot of us, we do bring up and we talk about how there's so many things that are taught, like wind turbines, for example, are brought up, that is a form of alternative, and solar panels. These are alternative energies that will maintain this way of life that we have currently. And no one wants to talk about the pollution that is caused by creating solar panels and wind turbines. Where's the mining come from? Who mines it? And whose land is destroyed in the mining of these precious, these rare metals? You know, who's exploited to have to build these things, and who's poisoned having to be by the manufacturing of these quote-unquote alternatives. I mean, in China, they have huge lakes, massive lakes, toxic lakes that come from wind turbines. And no one, especially, again, the white-dominated middle-class environmental movement, does not want to talk about this. And I think this is all about, you know, it's people, well, it's two things. People in the West have just kind of, it's just a kind of a no-brainer that, for so many people, that this way of life that we are living, we are, I mean, there's no way we can go back. There's no, I mean, this is, you know, we're entitled to this way of living. And there's no thinking of, and really even entertaining the idea that there is a cost to this, to the way that we are living our lives right now in terms of the human cost of human communities destroyed, ecosystems that are destroyed, what have you. And it's just a fantasy that's been created by so many, I mean, how I view it, that we could possibly, you know, with wind turbines and solar panels and various things, keep this all going. Again, also, I thought, thinking about it, I'm like, well, can any of these alternative energies happen without oil? Like, can you make these solar panels and wind turbines and what have you without oil, without the cars to transport them and build them and this and that? I mean, it's still reliant on an oil economy, you know, which is, and oil is a finite resource. It's running out. So for me, it's killing the planet in terms of climate change. So that doesn't sound like a real alternative, you know, in that sense either.
Like a Band-Aid or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I view it. I see them as Band-Aids to, you know, and we're not wanting to look honestly in the mirror and be honest about the fact that industrial civilization is just not, it's just not sustainable. And it's the hard pill to swallow, you mean, consider. You know, it's just, I'm thinking myself, I can't, I'm saying these things, but I cannot imagine living any other way, because this is the world that I've known, and finally having the skills and the knowledge to be able to survive without that is something those of us who do have this knowledge have a responsibility, as far as I'm concerned, to other people, you know, to get them as ready as possible in terms of, so, you know, food reliance, food sustainability, again, in terms of not being reliant on, also just in terms of not being reliant on the government. Talking with someone like the person I was telling you about, who from Deep Roots, who went to visit the Zapatistas, he was saying that they had this perspective that, I mean, some people think of it as an accomplishment that, say, after the Black Panther food programs, the government started doing that, you know, for children. And, you know, not a lot of people know that the Black Panthers did it first, but, you know, a lot of people in the West are like, oh, that was a progress that was made. And I guess, you know, from the Zapatistas' perspective, it wouldn't be a sense of, oh, that's progress, because now the people are, again, reliant on the government. And once that happens, you know, it's still, that's their form of control over us. And so just also in terms of revolutionary struggle, it's, that's a really important thing.
definitely, it's like the carrot and the stick, especially with talking about the Black Panthers. It's like, we'll shoot your leaders, but then we'll take your ideas and apply them on a wider basis and hopefully, suck up all of your support and leave you high and dry. And that's definitely, it's, a little bit more difficult to emulate the Black Panthers today because there are so many charities and nonprofits and churches who and government programs and what have you that do so many of the things that the Black Panther parties were trying to do back in their day. But I'm sure there's still room to do some of those serve the people programs, some of those dual power programs. And I was hoping to ask you a little bit more about some of that serve the people programs and survival programs that you're hoping to do here in the near future.
Yeah. Sorry, I was cutting you off there. I guess I got a little eager. you mentioned that, and there are a lot of programs and people doing good things out there, but there are people, still millions of Americans that go that are not, are food insecure, that are not eating enough. It's insane in a country that's so rich as this and throws away so much food, which I don't know, it's sinful, which is, disgusting that are going hungry every day. So it is still a very necessary, programs like that are still really necessary. Things like food sustainability, like teaching people to be able to grow their own food, even have their own, own chicken coops and things like that. I'm thinking of the cities of, or people have bought like city ordinances or different ordinances to be able to do things like that. Like housing, I'm really personally inspired by things I've looked at and researched with groups like Occupy Homes. And I'm trying to think if there's another group, based in Chicago, they've been doing really great work with taking over abandoned homes because the recession really hit them hard, and a lot of people being foreclosed on, and taking these homes and renovating them and putting people in them and all kinds of, and having people know their rights in that capacity. In fact, we have someone from a member, the same person, his name is Diego, who, went to visit the Zapatistas in New York. He's based in New York, doing a lot of work with tenants' rights because, again, they have a lot of problem with people being not having, being thrown out of their homes and this and that. Again, the fight for housing, the fight for land is really key. So being involved in those struggles, having a place, a place where, just thinking about having a place where there are these, established communities and, housing and these things in a local, an own economy that's being built is really important. And
definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Because the thing is, I was just going to say, because the thing is, I've noticed, that with us and then in our own personal experiences, and I think for a lot of groups, there's a lot of fighting to try and get more from the government, get the government to give us more, or to get, from our perspective, these white-dominated, really wealthy, organizations to try to go to the table in trying to get a piece of what they're giving. But I think it's important to break out of that. And I love, I know you just said a lot of things that inspired me today, but something Comrade Diego said is instead of trying to fight for a place at the table, building our own table.
Definitely, and that's what...
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, I didn't mean to cut you off. Keep on going.
Oh, I was just saying that really inspires me, building our own table. And with these, programs that we hope to be able to do at some point, that's what we have. That's where we really want to be coming from it at. And that's an idea, a lot of left groups, because, there needs to be lots of different groups, lots of different people doing these things, just you know, in general, to build a stronger, vibrant left, because the left has been so destroyed in this country and the consciousness so destroyed in this country. I think that's something that'd be important to remember.
Definitely, yeah, that's a good line about instead of fighting for a place at the table, fighting to build your own table. And that really kind of illustrates a lot about, you know, what kind of building dual power and your own sort of power base is about, and not kind of waiting for, you know, the government to step in and to, you know, quote-unquote help you, and in reality all they're doing is co-opting your movement at the same time. So, yeah, that's definitely a great point. Let's see, what else did I want to ask you? Oh, and, you know, you mentioned, you know, food sustainability, and that gets talked a lot about today, but that also has kind of implications in terms of imperialism and anti-imperialism, you know, especially talking about the environmental movement. Things like vegetarianism and veganism are really big, kind of alternative diets and lifestyle politics as a way to you know, mitigate one's carbon footprint, as they say, or their environment, their personal environmental impact. But a lot of times what's ignored is, you know, these tomatoes are picked by migrant workers in Latin America and Argentina, you know, people who are doused with chemicals, and even if you're buying little organic food from Mexico and stuff like that, you know, people who are still basically, you know, harshly exploited so that you can kind of have this feel-good sort of diet, which may or may not, probably not really change anything. So, you know, it's kind of interesting how within the environmental movement, how many kind of fads there are, which, you know, well, you know, I'm not going to say someone shouldn't be a vegetarian or something like that. I think it's probably healthier and all that. You know, I'm not going to say way to go, that's really going to change the system. And I'm sure you kind of run into that a lot. How do you approach that question of this, the kind of limited environmentalism that's very prevalent in the United States today?
That's another thing that a lot of us kind of view as a very sort of white middle class issue, if that makes sense. I mean, obviously there are people of color that are vegetarians and vegans, but just this big debate, you know, this kind of bickering that happens over it. I mean, we've actually had things where, you know, it's important to remember it's kind of, in some cultures, say with some of the indigenous comrades, we have, like, they ate buffalo, they are meat eaters, and it's a sign of disrespect. They cannot, you know, you're putting on an event, like, from there coming from, or a lot of us are coming from, do not offer meat there, you know.
Definitely, and
kind of,
yeah,
respect different cultures in that sense. And then, I'm glad you brought up the point of, like, who's picking these vegetables. Like, it's all tainted, because we live in industrial civilization and capitalism. It's all tainted, and I have utmost respect for people who, you know, decide to do that. The treatment of animals in the system in industrial farming is absolutely horrifying and disgusting and heart-wrenching. And people should rightfully be outraged about that. However, there is an element of privilege there, because, I mean, if you're poor, for example, you don't have access to a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, and you're going to get your macronutrients from meat, even if it's, say, McDonald's or whatever, or somewhere where it's not maybe the healthiest. Like, you're going to get the main nutrients you need to survive. And again, for people of color that live in poor people that live in food deserts, and you cannot spend a lot of money on these things, it's not feasible. And if people can do that, that's great. But this expectation that everyone can do that and that they really to solve the problem, I definitely disagree. And finally, I mean, it's very liberal, and the approach. I mean, your individual actions are your individual actions, but that's not a collective effort being made to dismantle a system that's harming animals or what have you. Like, again, there's important to understand these intersections. Like, you want to stop industrial farming or the consumption of these animals, But how are you, you can't do that if you're going to continue with industrial civilization, or if you're not going to effectively destroy capitalism. And then there's also a thing of, like, where do these animals go? I mean, because I read something about people, what was it, minks? I don't remember what it was. But they let up these animals, and they let them go, and to unintended, because it was like a farm, mink farm, for like their skin, their fur, and the unintended effect was they were let out, and it disrupted the local, the ecosystem there, you know, because it's a sad reality that some of these animals, like cows, are not indigenous to this continent. They're brought over. And, you know, what does that do for the overall ecosystem? Because it does have an effect. So, I mean, there's just all these different factors. I don't think it's an effective strategy to solve the problem.
I think you raised a good point about, you know, the what we need to do is build an economy that isn't reliant on, you know, cruelty to animals and torturing animals and all of that. And you know, being a vegetarian is great and all, or being a vegan, even better or whatnot, those individual actions alone are not going to produce that sort of result of building that larger economy that does, you know, have some modicum of respect for non-human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you definitely brought that up too, the kind of intersections, you know, it's kind of hard to expect people to treat animals like they would people whenever they treat people like animals half the time. You know, I saw that news story. What was it? Like, India Grants says that dolphins are now non-human people. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, what? Does India need, you know, a larger workforce or something like that? I mean, they treat their own people, you know, pretty harshly. I can't imagine what calling a dolphin non-human people is going to really do.
Right.
So I mean, there's all of that too. I mean, we definitely need a new system in which the potential exists to, you know, not treat animals like things.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And, you know, I'm of the view, I saw that, and I was just like, well, the treatment of women there needs to be... And very
Are they going to start raping dolphins on the streets now? It kind of made me wonder too.
Well, but the thing is, I also do think, like, okay, I mean, I haven't followed that closely, but if that results in better treatment of dolphins or what have you, then that's awesome. Because, I mean, I love the view, this is just me speaking, that I am a human being, so... I value the lives and feel more affinity with other human beings, but in an objective sense, I'm not worth more than dolphins or trees or any other being. And we are living creatures like any other, you know, being. So, I mean, I don't see there's anything wrong with consuming and eating other animals. It's the way in which we do it. And the waste, and again, like you kind of said, it's totally treating them like objects, like things. That's the problematic issue. That's what's problematic. But I mean, I'm speaking for me as an individual, like where I'm coming from with it.
Definitely. Well, we only have a few minutes left, I want to give you the chance. It goes by quick. I want to give you the chance to let people know how they can get a hold of you, how they can get involved, what they should, you know, where they can find you online, all of that stuff.
Great. We do have a website that I think is pretty nifty. if you Google Deep Roots United Front, deeproots.org, you can find us. Also, we have a Twitter account, so you put in Deep Roots United Front, Facebook page. It'd be really good to follow that. Finally, if you want to email us, if you're interested in helping in any way with the work that we do, or if you're a person of color and you're really interested in joining, email us at deeprootsunitedfront@riseup.net. So, deeprootsunitedfront@riseup.net, and And because there's a number of actions that in you know communities that we're involved with helping. So, in terms of people who want to be there in the front lines, also material support is really big. If there's any way you want to help in terms of supplies that you may have, or money or funds or whatever, we'd really appreciate it if you contacted us and we could start working together in some way.
Awesome. Well, thanks a bunch for joining us, and we look forward to hearing all the updates from your work. That's Jessica from Deep Roots United Front. Be sure to check us out next week. We are having on Ernesto Ayala from La Raza Unida Party. That's going to be pretty awesome. We're going to be talking about Chicano National Liberation in the Southwest. And I'm Nikolai Brown. This is Dialectics. See you next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jessica. Have a great one.
Yep.